From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there's news today that the longest war in American history could be nearing an end. The New York Times reports the U.S. peace envoy to Afghanistan and the Taliban have agreed to the framework of a peace deal. The U.S. has been fighting in Afghanistan since the 2001 September 11th attacks, which were planned in that country. Joining us now is the BBC's Sikandar Kermani. He's in Islamabad, Pakistan. Sikandar, what more do we know about this deal that's being reported in the New York Times?
So details about what was discussed during this latest set of talks are still emerging. Now, it seems that the progress that has been made that's got everyone feeling much more or so optimistic, really, seems to center on two particular issues. And that's getting a commitment from the U.S. that they're happy in principle to withdraw international forces from Afghanistan, which has long been a principal demand of the Taliban. And in return, the Taliban have been happy, it seems, to make a commitment that they won't allow Afghanistan to be turned into a base for international jihadist groups like al-Qaeda. But American officials are saying that any withdrawal is dependent on the Taliban declaring a ceasefire and, crucially, them agreeing to sit down and talk directly with the Afghan government, something that so far they've refused to do, dismissing the government in Kabul as a puppet regime.
Why isn't the Afghan government involved in these talks?
Well, certainly the Afghan government wants to be involved in these talks. Today, the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, gave a speech to the nation. In that speech, he called again on the Taliban to enter into direct talks with them. He said that that would be the only way to address concerns about human rights, to decide on what type of system of governance there would be in a future Afghanistan, an Afghanistan in which the Taliban is presumably some kind of key part of the political mainstream. But it's really been the Taliban all along who have been very reluctant to talk to the Afghan government. And that's, they say, that's because the real force in Afghanistan is not the Afghan government, but the American forces. So they've said they want to speak directly to the Americans. I think it's also partly because the Taliban likes to see itself as a government in waiting, and so they don't want to confer legitimacy on the current Afghan government. But this seems to be a kind of a deal-breaking part of the discussions. And so at the moment, we understand the Taliban are deliberating about what their position should be on talks with the Afghan government.
How much trust is there in the Taliban? We remember that the Taliban was in charge in Afghanistan when the war started so many years ago, had to be overthrown. There's been sort of on-again, off-again discussions with the Taliban, and now apparently, you know, there's this deal. So is there trust, though, of the Taliban leadership?
Well, certainly at the moment, it seems that steps towards peace have gone further than they have in the past. And both sides seem to be quite serious about this. Certainly, we know the American side, President Trump, is keen on withdrawing American troops because of the cost, because of the fact that the conflict is a kind of bloody stalemate. But I think there's also a desire on the part of the Taliban for peace. And that's partly because they're aware, I think, on some level that an outright decisive military victory would be difficult for them. And even if they were to achieve it, they wouldn't be able to govern with any real sense of international legitimacy. Whereas if they come through to a settlement through peace negotiations, then they could end up being some part of the government and you know, have a good relationship with other world powers. And some of the signs that the Taliban are serious about these negotiations can be seen from the fact that they appointed one of their founding members, the new head of their political office in Qatar. So he'll be in charge of these negotiations. His name is Mullah Barada, and he's seen as being someone who's open to peace within the organization, but also as someone who's got a lot of grassroots credibility and who can sell any kind of peace deal to the fighters who are on the ground in Afghanistan.
So what's the next step here? What will happen next?
So our understanding from speaking to a senior Taliban figure who's been involved in the talks himself is that both the Americans and the Taliban are now drawing up kind of technical teams to flesh out the details of what and how an American withdrawal would be and would look like. But also the Taliban will be thinking about this American demand that they declare a ceasefire and that they enter into negotiations with the Afghan government. The next round of discussions between the Taliban and the US will be at the end of February. So perhaps we'll see some further movement there. Certainly people in Afghanistan will be hoping for that.
That's the BBC's Sikandar Karmani joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan today. Sikandar, thank you.
Thank you.
Question: what would your office or home look like after 5 weeks away? Emails, bills would pile up, wouldn't they? Well, that's what federal workers are facing in their first day back on the job after the longest government shutdown in history. And it could take weeks or months for some to dig out of the backlog while wondering if there will be another shutdown on February 15th. The Washington Post's Juliet Alperin has taken a look. And Juliet, you and your colleagues have compiled an incredible list. Just give us a thumbnail.
Yes. I mean, it's really kind of extraordinary what they're facing. But you have, you know, IRS officials that are going to be looking not only working on processing people's tax refunds, but also looking at some of the complaints and questions that have come in about how to file for this tax year. At the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they estimate that they have something like 150 to 200 cases that have piled up over the past nearly 5 weeks when the government has been shut down. You know, you have a scientist at the Goddard Space Center that both has to check on a space telescope, but also she wants to water her plants to make sure they haven't died in the interim. So you've got a whole range of responses across the federal government.
Well, you mentioned the IRS. We understand there's a new tax code that many people haven't been trained in yet, so there's concern as to how long that's going to take. The National Transportation Safety Board has to decide which of almost 100 rail, plane, and highway crashes to investigate first. 100 have, you know, piled up, no pun intended, in the past 5 weeks. Plus, there's the little things like apparently if you work in the government, you have to have new passcodes.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, I think lots of people are familiar with the idea that you update your passcode, say, every 30 days and so forth. And so, you know, there's just a huge number of things that need to be reset. And so those are some of the challenges in this really unprecedented time we're in right now, given the length of the shutdown.
Well, and talk about funding, because some agencies are coming back. And in that 5 week interim, they've lost funding. We saw reporting in the Washington Post about some agencies, I believe, who weren't there to pay premiums on insurance. So people may not have insurance, but also funding for projects that got lost in the last 5 weeks.
Absolutely. I mean, there were deadlines for things in many cases, given how many rules there are about contracts and when you can spend money. There are these gaps. I know that I've been talking to folks about, say, some long-term projects they have, where the fact that they didn't start spending money on certain projects could mean that even though the government was only shut for a little more than 34 days, this means that critical infrastructure and projects are going to be delayed an entire year. So it really has huge ripple effects just because when you think of the bureaucracy involved in spending money in the federal government, it's different from how it is in the private sector.
Well, and you also spoke to people at the EPA. Just pick that agency. What are some of the concerns there?
There's a huge number of things they're doing to start things up and running. One of the things that really was starting to be a pressure point is there's a laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where experts certify whether a new model of car, truck, lawnmower, engine, and other vehicles, whether they meet our air standards. And because no one was on the job, literally there was one person guarding the physical security of the lab, you have at least one major auto company, Fiat Chrysler, hasn't been able to roll out a heavy-duty commercial truck, and you have other automakers who are concerned about that. So there's just a tremendous amount of work that hasn't been done.
Time cards have to be filled out again, so payroll staffs know who was furloughed, meaning people who were sent home and should be eligible for back pay, but then there were people who worked without pay, people who called in sick, worked overtime. Or, you know, talk about the unique issues surrounding contract workers. It seems like many agencies are waiting to see who comes back, because if they weren't getting paid at all and aren't promised any back pay, people might have gone on to other jobs.
Absolutely. So that's one of the issues coming on, which is that, you know, there's, for example, there's a group which represents roughly 400 private government contractors. And one of the top people from that group let us know that essentially during this interim, some contractors might have reassigned people who were working on government projects to work in the private sector on other issues. And so as a result, you know, you might have a team that was working to execute a priority for an agency where now some of the members of that team are missing, because really it's really is the government contractors who are hit hardest by the shutdown, given that they won't be receiving any back payment.
Yeah. So it's going to be a lurching government and one looking over its shoulder at a possible another shutdown in 3 weeks. But as you report, I mean, the little things too, watering plants and in many offices, take down that Christmas tree and holiday menorah.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting factoids, I think, that it turns out that in the Merit Systems Protection Board, there is still a Christmas tree and a Hanukkah menorah, because the vice chairman explained there was no one able to take them down. So we imagine that as of today, that will probably be updated. Yeah.
Juliet Alperin, Senior National Affairs Reporter for The Washington Post. What it takes to restart a government. Juliet, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
And if you went back today, how'd it go? Let us know here at now.org. A bit ago, we reported on the top food trends for 2019, and on all of the lists, mushrooms, or mycelia, as their root systems are known. Then, on a recent trip to a favorite shop, Cambridge Naturals, everywhere you looked, mushrooms, mushroom tea, mushroom immunotherapy. On prominent display, the 2005 book, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World, by Paul Stamets, who also seems to be everywhere, including a recent piece in the New York Times about saving the endangered honeybee population with mushrooms. Yes, they're delicious, but Stamets says mushrooms have unique properties. Some exude acids and enzymes that can break down oil, even nuclear waste. And most important, mushrooms get sick just like we do, and in order to ward off pathogens, they've created antibacterial and antiviral defenses we can harness. In fact, Paul Stamets thinks mushrooms may play as important a role as penicillin has. Well, for a guy who spends a lot of his time on the ground looking for mushrooms, he's achieved a pretty elevated status with a revered TED Talk, admirers like Leonardo DiCaprio and Bill Gates. He's been described as a modern-day Thomas Edison by Department of Defense scientists. He prefers mycological warrior in defense of the planet. And Paul Stamets joins us now from Olympia, Washington. Paul, how is the rarefied air up there? You're just...
Well, if you can see me, I'd be blushing. you're very kind, and my supporters are all too kind, but I do appreciate the support. I need it.
You feel as if there's been a certain kind of shift. You've been talking about this for quite a while now, and suddenly mushrooms are everywhere.
Yeah, it's become our current zeitgeist. People are waking up to the fact there's a hidden underground network underneath every footstep that we take. The interface organs between life and death, and they build soils. And without fungi, we wouldn't have food.
Mushrooms break down and build up soil. But talk about their ability to heal humans and the connection between humans and fungi.
Well, the connection goes back 650 million years ago. Fungi gave birth to animals. We have a much closer ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. And there actually is a new super kingdom called Opisthokonta that joined Animalia and fungi together. Fun esoteric science, but it's true. And we share in common many of the pathogens that attack fungi are also pathogenic to us. So the defenses that fungi have built over millions of years can be very useful for protecting animals from the same disease vectors that plague fungi. So we hold in common some of the same microbial enemies, you might say, and as well as the microbial allies.
Okay, let me see if I've got this. You say that we are so close to fungi, we share 50% of the same DNA, we get many of the same viruses. So you've been focusing on finding the natural immunities that fungi have developed to germs and extracting them to try to help us, if I'm on the right track there. And where do you think this can work the best?
The take home here for the listeners is that bees are facing a dramatic stressors. But really, the nail in the coffin, has been identified recently, is coming from the varroa mite. And the varroa mite is injecting deadly viruses into bees. Now, 30% of the food that we consume is directly dependent upon bee pollination. Every almond that you eat was visited by a bee on a flower. So they're critical for commercial agriculture. They're commercial for ecosystem equilibrium. And the bees are plummeting in their populations across the world. And we have found, through a very bizarre twist and turns of my life, discovered that some of these polypore mushrooms, these hard wood conchs that grow on trees, when you make an extract of the mycelium, the fine fuzzy stuff growing on the ground, go outside and tip over any log and you'll see mycelium on the ground, that those fine furry fibers, when we extract them and we give them to bees, it reduces the viruses by thousands of times with one treatment 12 days later, and also substantially increases their lifespan.
And this work you did with scientists at Washington State University and the U.S. Department of Agriculture sounds wonderful. You want to apply this kind of thinking in other areas, tuberculosis, other kinds of illnesses, other mushrooms. You know, one criticism of you has been that there's not enough data, study. Take that, because I can hear listeners saying, well, if this is true, why am I not going to the drugstore and getting mushroom aspirin or whatever? I mean, what has been the disconnect between what people really believe you're onto and it not being common usage?
Excellent question. And I welcome my critics. And please, critics out there, you know, I love to engage. I love to respond with data. It will become more common. It is becoming more common. The wave of scientific articles coming out supporting the immune enhancing benefits of these mushroom species is just tremendous. And directly after 9/11, I was engaged by the U.S. Defense Department BioShield BioDefense program called Project BioDefense, funded with several billion dollars. We found resident in the old growth forest a mushroom called agaricon. Mm-hmm. It grows exclusively in the old growth forest. That turned out to be in the top 10 of all samples that they tested, of more than 2 million samples, the only natural product that reduced pox viruses. And bioterrorism was a huge concern. The BioShield BioDefense program then steered the research. They did 2,392 assays. Thank you, George Bush and Dick Cheney. Crazy, crazy that I'm saying that, but it's true. So we found that these extracts in vitro with the BioDefense program reduced flu viruses, H5N1, H3N2, H1N1, swine flu, and bird flu, as well as herpes.
Yeah. You have had interest from U.S. Department of Agriculture, Homeland Security. We mentioned the Defense Department. Companies have contacted you about oyster mushrooms being able to clean up oil spills. You've had University of Illinois, Chicago's Institute for Tuberculosis Research sent you analysis of these agaricon strains that you'd cultured in your lab. This is for the fight against tuberculosis. Where do you think this is leading? I mean, I talk about going into health food stores, and all I see are mushroom products.
So I'm going to state something extraordinary.
Go ahead.
But I believe this is true. I believe in my gut it is true. What I think I've discovered is something fundamental to the foundation of nature. The mycelium that is growing in the ecosystem that builds the soils not only controls the microbiome, but it influences, if not controls, the immunological health of the animal inhabitants that are resident within the environment. What's happening around the world is as we experience deforestation, we remove the menu of wood debris necessary for the fungi to create soils. And as we limit the wood debris fields, then we stress the ecosystem because mycodiversity, the diversity of fungi, declines. And we don't have as many species with skill sets to be able to rise up to help reestablish equilibrium in the ecosystem. Hmm. So that's just think of it. The same polypore mushrooms have this effect on multiple viruses that afflict multiple species of animals. So we do have an animal clinical study. It's the bees. Now, we need to have other animal clinical studies. Who's going to fund them? In the pharmaceutical industry, I have no doubt they looked at agaricon. It's the longest living growing mushroom in the world. It grows up for 70, 80 years. I submitted 7 strains of agaricon to the Project BioDefense. Only 3 of them showed activity. So if a pharmaceutical company, they could have very well have missed this because different strains within a species are critically important. A clear example, the penicillium mold. When it was first discovered to inhibit staph bacteria and other bacteria, it inhibited the bacteria, but it wasn't that potent. And then only because some researchers in Chicago got a moldy piece of fruit from a market, they found a hyper-producing strain, which allowed for the commercialization of the most potent antibiotic known in the history of medicine. And the discovery of penicillin may have tilted the balance in winning World War II, because the British and the Americans had this strain of penicillium, and the Axis powers, the Germans and Japanese and Italians, did not. Biodiversity is biosecurity. This fabric of life that we exist today is dependent upon the fungal networks that we walk upon with every footstep that we take. And I feel potently the voices of my descendants calling back in time, telling us to wake up. We are at a tipping point. The loss of insect diversity is a huge threat right now to the fabric of our ecosystem. The majority of insects feed upon fungi, and the loss of the fungal menu available to insects is yet another challenge. The good news is I know of no other science that has so many potential solutions that are deliverables, that are ecologically rational, economically scalable, and that can be put into place in the short term. The field of mycology, in my opinion, should be funded to the tune of NASA, because this is so critical for the survival of life on this planet. There's no other science I know that's so underfunded, underrecognized, and underappreciated, and yet has so much potential.
Paul Stamets, again, a mycologist in Olympia, Washington, author of the 2005 book, still very much present, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. Paul, we're going to have to stop here. We could go on, and maybe we will down the road, but thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you very much for your support of science and educating the public on eclectic knowledge.
Take care.
All right.
And by the way, Paul's work is supported by his online company, Fungi Perfect Eye. And no, you won't find any magic psychedelic mushrooms for sale there, although Paul says he does support the research, as does author Michael Pollan. So we'd love your thoughts. Are you a shiitake lover, a forager? Are you taking mushroom products like immunotherapy? Weigh in here and now.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Today, the federal government predicted that the U.S. budget deficit will hit nearly $900 billion by the end of the year. That's up 15% from 2018. You could blame the slowing economy and the boost from the new Republican tax law, which is wearing off. And speaking of that new law, this is the opening day of tax season. Today's the first day you can file returns with the IRS, the first filing period since the new tax law went into effect. So let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
I don't hear a lot of joy that this is the first day of tax season. What's going on?
Woohoo! Well, it's not like, opening day for a baseball team. It's just not the same. But this new law nearly doubled the standard deduction. Supporters said that would make tax filing easier, maybe give you a bigger return. You say what?
Yes. I mean, if you are lucky enough to claim the standard deduction, it probably will be easier than going through your itemized deductions. And just a reminder. So here's what we're talking about. There's a bunch of stuff that you get credit for and you tally it all up. And if it's more than $12,000 as an individual, $24,000 married filing jointly, $18,000 if you're claiming head of household, if it's more than that threshold, then you itemize, you list all these different deductions. Otherwise, you get this one standard deduction, and it does make filing a lot easier. So last year, about 70% of filers, they claimed standard deduction. And right now, we're looking at maybe 85 up to 90% of taxpayers will be able to claim the standard deduction. So it should be easier for them.
Yeah, but what should people know to expect and what they get in return?
Well, this is what's going to be really weird, because during the year, you may have had a fatter paycheck, right? You might have actually had your withholding adjusted. So it may be that your total taxes paid went down from 1 year to the, from the previous year. Okay. And that would be good news, but it also may mean that you've already gotten that money. You may not get the same refund that you got in the previous years. So this is going to be a little bit of a zany tax season because it is this first time with the new law. Some people are going to say, gosh, I got a rotten refund. Others are going to get bigger refunds and they'll make adjustments going further. And then still others, they're going to say it's a double whammy. Not only did my tax bill go up, and I actually owe a lot more in taxes. I did not withhold properly.
No. Okay, so you can straighten that out maybe for next year. But meanwhile, zany year, yes, because the IRS, of course, got slammed during the shutdown. They have a backlog of 5 million unanswered pieces of mail. According to some reporting, 26 IT professionals were quitting every week. Some 2,000 new employees have not been trained on how to answer your questions about this new tax law. So what's your sense of when returns might come?
You know, it's funny because in the beginning of the shutdown, the IRS came out and said, don't worry about it. Everything's on track. We're going to issue refunds in the same way we have in the past, which is about 3 weeks when you file electronically and up to 6 weeks for paper returns. Now, we had a lot of conversations in the last couple of weeks about really what the IRS could do. I'm hearing some stories about employers who are trying to reach the IRS and having some problems getting some of the tax documents out to workers. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. At the very least, just know this. April 15th, that is the deadline, unless you live in, you know, a specific state, like if you're in the D.C. or Massachusetts. But that's your date. Don't blow it off.
And Jill, we are hearing your dog, and we love that when we do. Oh, Jill Schlesinger.
They hate paying taxes, but they're very good. They do it every single year.
A deduction. Oh, yeah. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
For many Americans, posting on social media is a daily habit, and for some parents, that includes sharing photos of young children. But our next guest says some parents are going too far, oversharing or sharenting about their kids' lives in the digital world. Stacy Steinberg is a law professor at the University of Florida's Levin College of Law. When I spoke with her, she wanted to be so careful about sharing information about her kids that she asked us to bleep their ages, which we will. Stacy, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me today.
So a 2010 survey found 90% of two-year-olds have an online presence. And I am betting, I don't know this for a fact, but I am betting that 0% of them agree to that themselves.
I think they'd probably be too young to agree at that point. But yes, they haven't agreed to it, and they are all over the internet.
Is that a problem when you think about it?
You know, I don't necessarily think it's a problem. I think it's kind of a cultural shift that we've seen in the way that kids come of age today. Social media has only been around for, you know, about a decade or so. And so as parents, we're first learning about social media at the same time that we're talking about our kids. And as our pride and joy, we want to share them.
Well, and you post all the time, apparently, about your three children aged and what do you consider before posting online about them?
Well, I try not to post all the time, but I do share updates with my friends and family who are on social media. And I try to always think about how they would feel about the information that I'm sharing. I think about how would they perceive the information if they knew right now that I was posting it, but also how could this information affect them years later as they become adults?
And how do you think that it could affect them? Or what do you think would be a problem for them as they become adults?
Well, I think our kids need to be able to come of age in a way that they have control over their digital footprint. And so when we share about our kids online, it's really important that we keep in mind that we don't know who they will become as they grow up. So it's really important that before we press share on our digital devices, so to speak, that we really think about who they might become, who they might want to become, and how can we best give them an opportunity to control this new digital identity that they'll grow to be in charge of one day.
But the best answer is not just to not post at all about them?
For some parents, not posting at all is a great choice, and I certainly encourage parents to think about it and make the best decisions for their families. I'm not telling parents to keep sharing or to not share. I just think that it's really important that when they do share, that they think about how their kids might be feeling about it and how they can best do it safely. So there's certain information that parents, I think, should never share about their kids. And I think that parents are really the best people to make those decisions. It's like any other aspect of parenting. There's many different sides to how one person might choose to raise their kids, how they might discipline them, how they might feed them. The problem with social media is that it's such a new environment that we don't have a lot of guidance to guide us as we go about, you know, living our lives and communicating with friends and family online. And so what I really advocate for is for parents to get that guidance so that they can make well-informed choices for their
family. Is it dangerous to post the child's birthday? And apparently, according to a study from the University of Florida, 6%, more than 6% of posts reference a child's birthday.
I think that it's not necessarily dangerous to post a child's birthday, but it's something that parents should keep in mind, that there are people that might be out there wanting to harm your kids. There might be people out there who are collecting information or digital dossiers. And so if parents make the decision to disclose that, they need to do so with an understanding that that information might be interesting, not just to their friends and family, but it might also be interesting to people they've never met or companies that they are not even aware of.
Is there a rights issue? Do you think we're ever going to get to a point, maybe 10 years from now, where some kid grows up and sues his or her parents over things that were posted about them online before they were able to say yes or no?
I think so. I do think that eventually we will see this maybe play out in the court system. You know, the issue is how can we best balance the rights of parents to share with the rights of kids to control their privacy? In the United States, we have very strong First Amendment protections, which really give parents and all of us the right to say a lot of things. But we also do recognize that people, including kids, have a right to privacy or at least have an interest in privacy. And so I think at some point we might see this play out in the court system. But for the most part, I think the law is really best left to regulate sharenting, so to speak, at the margins. But really a more public health model of child protection, where we encourage parents to think deeply about what it is that they're sharing and what type of digital footprint they're leaving in childhood's wake, it's best for us to give them the information so that they can make these decisions on their own.
Well, and do you think that it's best to keep the photo sharing, for example, in a private group that you control who gets to see it?
I think parents always need to be aware of who's going to be able to see or access their pictures. For many parents, that means limiting it to a private group. But we also nowadays have a lot of people who choose to share on public spaces or with very large audiences on Facebook. The problem is that there is a lot of benefit to sharing our stories and to building our communities. And for parents, when they're sharing about their lives and they're sharing about their kids, you know, they're doing it both for themselves to gain something from it, but they're also doing it maybe to shift conversations about what it is to parent in America or what it is to parent a special needs child. And I don't think we need to silence that voice, but parents do need to recognize that if they are sharing publicly, that those pictures can be saved and used in many ways over the course of a child's life.
What are you going to say to your world when they turn, you know, 12, 13, 14, and they find out that they have this whole social media presence that they had nothing to do with that's out there?
Well, I actually talk to my kids before I post pictures of them, and I'm very protective of what information is out there and who the audience might be for the pictures. I don't really think that my child would one day wake up and be surprised by it, because anytime I post a picture of my child, even my year old, you know, I talk to her about, you know, do you want this picture to be seen? Do you want other people to understand it? Now, of course, that conversation is very different with a 5-year-old versus with an 8-year-old or, you know, a soon to be 13-year-old. But I do have that conversation regularly. And I think that parents who don't have that conversation absolutely need to be prepared for one day that their child may find this trail that's been left from all the years that they have been growing up.
I mean, I know that I've seen pictures that friends have posted of, you know, their baby sitting in a bathtub, maybe not, you know, fully naked that you can see, but definitely a naked baby in a bathtub.
Absolutely. And that's why in my law review article in the Emory Law Journal, and also in JAMA Pediatrics with a pediatrician, I recommended that there are some best practices that parents can consider when they do choose to share pictures of their kids online. And one of them is to think about not posting things that might be embarrassing to them later on.
Mm-hmm. What are the other best practices that you would want parents to know?
I think that parents need to be familiar with the privacy policies on any websites that they're sharing. I think it's also important that parents give, especially older children, veto power over any online disclosures that they're planning on making. I think parents need to be aware that while they might see a picture to be an innocent picture of their adorable child, that there are people who might have sinister motives and might see that differently. And so parents should avoid posting any pictures of their kids in any state of undress. And then I think that parents need to consider their child's well-being, both their well-being now, if the child saw it or the child's friend saw it, but also their well-being years into the future if they were to one day stumble across the digital media, the digital footprint that was left.
Stacey, this digital world is changing so quickly. I just wonder, as you think about this issue, where do you think sharenting is headed? What's the future hold?
You know, I think that as we all get more comfortable with social media and the online world that we're all living in, I do think that parents are going to be thinking a little bit more cautiously and a little bit more proactively about what it is that they're putting out there online. You know, for parents who have, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, their children have grown up while the parents have first gotten social media to begin with. And so as we have more information, as we have more studies that show us how kids are feeling about the information that's been out there, I think that parents are going to be better equipped to be able to make smarter parenting decisions. You know, just a few years ago, a study came out that said that 1 in 4 kids are embarrassed by the information that their parents are sharing at them. And that there's another study that says that by age 9, kids have really strong reactions to the digital data that their parents are putting forth on social media. There's also been studies that show that kids are twice as likely as adults to say that adults overshare and that adults should not overshare. So I think as more of this information becomes part of child rearing discourse, we'll see that parents probably will be sharing less, or at least will be sharing smarter.
That is Stacey Steinberg, who is a law professor at the University of Florida's Levin College of Law. We'll link you to more of her work on this at hereandnow.org. Stacey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you are a parent of a young child, rather than sharing any photos of them today, let us know what you think about sharenting at hereandnow.org.
Last year, Jackson Hole Mountain Resort in Wyoming launched a new extreme skiing competition. At the award ceremony, photos of the top male and female skiers went viral, drawing ridicule because the guy won $5,000 more than the top woman did. The resort immediately pulled together funds to close the gap, but as Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports, equal prizes are not guaranteed in big mountain skiing.
At the count of one, 24-year-old Kate Seliff soared off a snowy cliff. She pulled a shifty, kicking the tails of her skis to the left and straightening them again as she dropped into the world-famous ski run known as Corbett's Couloir. Flanked by rock walls on either side, she made a flawless landing, took some graceful turns, and launched off a jump into a spread eagle before cruising across the finish line. For that stellar run, Zeliff was crowned Queen of Corbett's Couloir and handed a check.
I was so blown away by what that meant for my skiing and what that meant for me and potentially my career and all these other things that I didn't even look that Carl won X amount of dollars and what my check said.
But other people noticed that her check said $3,000, while the King of Corbett's held a check for $8,000. An Instagram post with images of the checks called out Jackson Hole for perpetuating the gender wage gap. Zeliff says by the next day, the resort had fixed the disparity, but that wasn't the end of the discussion.
What was interesting was the next day when I was getting phone calls and texts and emails like, aren't you? I was like, whoa, I didn't even think about it, to be honest.
As a young skier just entering her pro career, she was excited to be winning any money at all. But she admits paying attention to these issues is what leads to change. Tom Winter agrees.
It's good to see people having these conversations because obviously awareness that things could be done better. That awareness, once you have it, starts helping you look for solutions.
Winter is the Americas manager for the Free Ride World Tour. At the annual series of competitions, the best free skiers in the world vie for the world champion title. But to get on the world tour, a skier must qualify. And Winter says at the qualifying competitions, the prizes aren't always equal.
usually when you have events that are fueled with entry fees, that impacts prize purse funds on offer for athletes.
In other words, the more athletes in a given category, the more money they're competing to win. Winter says that puts women at a disadvantage because fewer of them compete.
We need to start asking questions of event organizers about parity and about participation.
Winter says the International Free Skiers and Snowboarders Association sets guidelines for competitions, but resorts aren't required to provide equal prizes. But if they did, Winter says it would entice more women to pursue competitive big mountain free skiing. He points out women can't be expected to achieve the same degree of athleticism or take the same risks as men if they don't have access to the same resources. And there are resorts who figured out how to make sure they do. Grand Targhee in Wyoming is one of them. So is Crystal Mountain in Washington State, where Brianna Stoutenberg is the events coordinator.
You know, the men and the women, they're skiing the same terrain. That's really important to me as an event coordinator, that we do provide the same payout essentially to the men and the women.
I asked Stoutenberg about Tom Winter's point that when fewer women compete, there's less prize money to go around. She says there's an easy fix. Pool the entry fees from the men and women together, then divide accordingly to provide cash prizes to the top female and male finishers. Men might get less with this equation, but Stoutenberg hasn't heard complaints.
It seems to have worked for our resort and our athletes for the past 5 years or so.
Tom Winter, who's been involved in competitive skiing for 30 years, says consumers can help promote good practices by supporting the resorts and event sponsors who do the right thing.
I think that consumers should be activists. I think they should let brands and companies and people know how they feel. They should be engaged. That's how change happens.
Winter says free skiing should take a lesson from the World Surf League. Starting this year, male and female surfers will be getting equal prizes at World Surf League competitions. Kate Zeliff, the 2018 Queen of Corbett's, is optimistic that wave of change will reach the mountains. She just competed in a free ride World Tour qualifier at Revelstoke Mountain Resort in British Columbia. She texted to tell me how it went. The message said, "Got third place and the prize money is equal." Exclamation point. For Here and Now, I'm Tennessee Watson.
And we're also keeping an eye out today on that measles outbreak in Washington State. Public health officials have confirmed 34 cases of measles and identified 9 more suspected cases in Clark County, which borders Portland, Oregon. Most of the infections involve children who have not been vaccinated. Clark County's public health director, Alan Melnick, told KGW News measles is highly contagious.
It can have really serious complications, including pneumonia, swelling of the brain or encephalitis, and miscarriage in pregnant women. And it's entirely, completely, utterly preventable with an incredibly effective, cheap, safe vaccine.
The Washington State Department of Public Health is urging residents to get in touch if they have symptoms. The governor has declared a state of emergency. We'll keep an eye on it all. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.